Freunde des gepflegten Korbballsports, herzlich willkommen zur neuen Ausgabe unseres Korbjäger-Podcasts. Schön, dass ihr wieder dabei seid zur zweiten Ausgabe ohne Ole. Spitzenalliteration, ein trauriger Fakt, natürlich mit umso schönerem Grund. Deshalb überlegen wir uns einfach, wie wir weitermachen können, beziehungsweise wir haben einen Weg gefunden, wie wir weitermachen können und tun etwas, was wir wahrscheinlich eigentlich schon lange hätten tun sollen. Ich glaube, alle warten drauf, vor allem ich habe drauf gewartet. Wir sprechen heute einzig und allein über die allmächtigen Chicago Bulls. Und damit da auch noch mehr Substanz dahinter ist, habe ich mir Verstärkung geholt und zwar direkt aus Chicago. Matt Peck war so nett, sich mit mir zu unterhalten. Matt ist Bulls-Fan seit Kindestagen, covert die Bulls auch seit Jahren. Momentan ist er Co-Host des Locked On Bulls Podcast, wo ihr fünfmal die Woche alles zu den Bulls hören könnt. Er hatte eine Fernsehsendung bei NBC Sports Chicago, Bulls Outsiders, damals mit David Watson und John Sabine haben sie über die Spiele der Bulls gesprochen und Matt hat definitiv einiges zu erzählen, natürlich über die ganz schönen Zeiten, über die etwas, dunkleren Zeiten, auch über die Offseason haben wir gesprochen. Mir hat es auf jeden Fall riesen Spaß gemacht und ich hoffe, euch macht es auch Spaß. Jetzt ist natürlich so auch einiges passiert in der NBA, ne? Joel Embiid hat seinen Vertrag verlängert, Marcus Smart hat verlängert, es gab einen Trade und danach nochmal einen Trade. Patrick Beverley erst zu den Grizzlies, jetzt bei den Wolves. Eric Bledsoe zurück zu den Clippers nach Jahren. Und ich habe mir jetzt schon auch überlegt, ob ich jetzt ein bisschen was dazu sagen soll. Andererseits fehlt mein Partner einfach. Ohne Ole ist schwierig. Und ohne Ole ist so ein bisschen wie Tennis gegen eine Wand spielen. Ganz nett, aber es fehlt einfach was. Deswegen, wie gesagt, heute gehört die Bühne den Chicago Bulls. Und das wird auch gleich so sein. Kurz vorher natürlich noch ganz kurz der Hinweis auf unsere Patreon-Seite. Denn unter patreon.com/Korbjäger-Podcast und Korbjäger mit AE, vollkommen richtig, könnt ihr uns mit monatlichen Beiträgen unterstützen, wenn ihr das wollt. Vielen, vielen Dank an alle, die es schon tun und vielen, vielen Dank vor allem auch an alle, die uns treu bleiben, weil auf dieser Seite passiert momentan natürlich deutlich weniger, als es eigentlich sollte, aus gegebenem Anlass. Wir werden das aber, sobald wir wieder etwas mehr Freiraum haben, beziehungsweise wir uns an die neue Situation alle gewöhnt haben, werden wir natürlich wieder ein bisschen mehr liefern. Von daher vielen Dank, dass ihr uns da treu geblieben seid und jetzt ohne Umschweife rein ins Gespräch mit Matt Peck. Viel Spaß dabei. Alright, and there he is. Matt Peck is here. Welcome to the show.
Absolutely, thanks for having me.
So, I think the first question for every Bulls fan, how did you get accustomed to the Bulls?
I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago since I was 3 years old. My family moved to Chicago when I was three, and I just, being a Bulls fan in the late 80s, early 90s, it was just ingrained in your DNA as a Chicagoan or a proxy suburbs Chicagoan that you were following the Bulls and Michael Jordan and Scotty and that amazing story. I mean, it defined my childhood. So, you know, I've been a Bulls fan ever since I was a tiny little kid. Obviously, I was spoiled with championships, six of them in my childhood. And then there were the dark years. But I was so hooked with being in love with the team, with the two three-peats, that even after that dynasty split up, like, I still followed the team religiously through my young adolescence and then on through, you know, my high school years, my collegiate years. So when it seemed like we were just lost in the desert for forever. Yeah. They get really lucky in the draft lottery in 2008. They get the number one pick. They draft the hometown kid, Derrick Rose, and he just skyrockets. Rookie of the year, all-star, youngest MVP in the league. And so, like, I was committed to the team throughout all of those dark years. But it is kind of frustrating that in all of my years of Bulls fandom, I guess maybe it's like, okay, you got the championships when you were a kid, so now you just have to wait a really, really long time. Because with the Derrick Rose and the Tom Thibodeau and the Joakim Bulls, we thought we were on deck for at least another championship or two if that team could get over that hump. And, you know, like it was getting over the Pistons hump for the old school Bulls. Clearly, you were trying to get past over the LeBron James hump, whether it was Miami or Cleveland. And that was something really exciting and certainly worth rooting for. We didn't get there. And now we've obviously, as you know, started all over again. I think Bulls fans are now really excited with some of these offseason moves that I'm sure we'll talk about in a little while, because it feels like for the first time in a long time, the Bulls might be relevant again this upcoming season.
It really does seem so. I think last season was like, we got a glimpse, Zach LaVine, like, performed really well, developed really well. But yeah, those Noah years and Rose years, that was, it felt like something was coming together. I really love those teams as well. I'm going to ask you a little about those guys later. But
Well, you said that you grew up being a Bulls fan. So what was your first memory that you can really point to when thinking about the Bulls?
So I remember watching their championship rally in Grant Park, which is, you know, Chicago Park, where all of the Chicago championship teams, all of their parades end at Grant Park for the championship mm-hmm. rally. And they, you know, they televised them. So I wasn't at the championship rally, but I remember watching it in my living room, in my family's house in 1991, their first championship. I don't even really remember watching the games, the NBA finals mm-hmm. against the Lakers. You know, of course, like now, like MJ's iconic switch hands in midair from that yeah. Bulls Lakers championship series, like it's ingrained in my brain. But I was 5 years old in the 1991 NBA finals. Yeah. Like I don't remember the basketball that I watched, but I have a visceral memory of watching the championship rally live coverage on TV. And I was like, that is one of my first memories ever in my brain. Uh-huh. And that was okay. Then all of a sudden it was like, you know, first grade, every shirt that I wear to school every day is Bulls related, the Bulls championship shirts, you know, MJ shirts, Scotty jersey. Like it just took over my childhood from when I was 5 years old. And it's most of what I remember as a kid was like every day, you know, the mom's like, okay, first day of school, let's take a picture in the front yard before you walk to school. I was wearing Bulls gear every year of all of my nice. Grade school years. First day of school, I'm wearing a Bulls jersey of some kind.
You got to dress up for the first day, don't you?
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's it. I was actually a bit similar with me because a friend of mine, of my parents, she came over from the States and she introduced me to the Bulls right after the 93 finals. And they broadcasted on Austrian TV. It was a relive. So that's my first memory. And from then on, she always gave me Bulls t-shirts and stuff. So I really love to wear them at school as well. Because, I mean, they were beautiful, weren't they? And they still are, right? Still are, right? Yeah. So who's been your favorite player back then? I mean, obviously, MJ and Scotty and later. But has there been someone like from the second tier players or someone?
When I was younger, like during the dynasty, obviously, I worshipped MJ. I mean, if you can see behind me on the wall, that's an autographed MJ jersey from when I went to Michael Jordan basketball camp in the summer of 98 after their final championship.
And it's the pinstripe one.
And it's the pinstripe. And it's signed by MJ. That's why it's framed in a glass case. obviously, MJ is always the answer. 1A, yes, of course. Favorite Bull of all time. He's my favorite athlete of all time. The second three-peat, when I was older and really starting to like follow the team and fall in love with the team, I fell in love with Dennis Rodman instantly. So like Rodman has always been my 1B answer of favorite Bulls of all time. A lot of Bulls fans who are older than me and remember him being an integral piece of the Bad Boy Pistons, I think it took them maybe a little longer to warm up to Dennis Rodman because they were used to Dennis Rodman beating up Scottie Pippen and beating up the Bulls and just being that menace that was a piece of a team that the Bulls fans hated. But I was too young to really remember the Bulls-Pistons rivalry. So when we got him in a trade, and I was like, wait, all we gave up was an aging Will Perdue for Dennis Rodman? Like, multi-time defensive player of the year. The guy is, you know, leading the league in rebounds every season. That guy? And then he showed up at his press conference with that amazing hairdo where he's got red-dyed hair and a black Bulls logo on the back of his hair.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is my favorite player of all time now. I was like, I love this guy. I'm hooked. The tattoos, the autobiography where he's like sitting naked on a motorcycle with a basketball cover in his junk. I had to beg and plead my parents to let me get that book because they were like, you know, no, this is a book about a professional athlete telling all of his wild stories of exploits and sex and drugs and rock and roll. And I was like 9 years old and I was like, I want to read the book. they eventually caved and let me get the book on, you know?
Okay.
So Rodman has always been my 1B answer. And 1C, you can see him behind me on the wall too.
Oh yeah.
Is Joakim Noah.
Joakim Noah. Great player. Great guy too, right?
Yeah. So I mean, my goal in life is to be best friends with Joakim Noah someday. I haven't gotten there yet. Yeah. And I'm crossing my fingers that the Bulls roster is not at 15 yet. Get that dude out of retirement. We need some front court depth. We need some rim protection. We need some toughness on this team. And I don't know about you.
Leadership.
I follow Joakim on Instagram. I'm always stalking him on Instagram. That dude's still working out. He looks cut. He looks like he's in really good shape.
He does. Yeah.
That I would love to see him back. I don't think it's likely at all. It seems like he's very much enjoying retirement, and good for him.
It looks like it. Yeah.
Just hanging out in Hawaii with his model wife. So, you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And he traveled Africa or something to
he was a big piece of opening up that African basketball league.
Yep. Right. So, yeah, he's enjoying it. But would have needed to retire a Bull. So,
right. I still think he will do the whole, like, you know, one day contract kind of thing.
Once the fans are back and.
Right. Because he did go to a game at the United Center last season, but it was still while Bulls were not allowing fans in because they only let in fans for like the last couple of games of the season. And so like they showed him on the big screen because he was like, you know, a guest of the Reinsdorfs because he happened to be in Chicago that week. And so, you know, he got like a little wave, but like the stadium was empty. So I'm hoping that they bring him back and give him a more formal thank you / retirement party when there are fans in the stands, and hopefully that happens this season. But I don't know. Yeah. We're on wave number 4 in COVID here in the States because of all these freaking anti-vaxxers, and so I hope we have fans in the United Center this season. Yeah. But I honestly don't know if we will at this point. We just heard. I just saw it on my Twitter feed right before we started that Chicago is about to announce a new indoor mask mandate, like today or tomorrow.
Oh, really? Okay. Oh, wow.
So. Who knows where we're going to be when the season starts in a couple of months.
And the Bulls were among the last teams to actually allow fans back into the arena at the end of the season, right? So many teams...
Like second to last, if not the very last.
Yeah. So, yeah, during the playoffs, it was crazy. Like, especially watching it from over here where they got in football stadiums, or soccer stadiums, as you say, sorry.
I knew what you meant.
They had about like 10, like in a 70,000 people stadium, they're about 15,000 people. And so, and in playoffs, the arenas were like full and packed with people.
Yeah.
But, those... So you had those nice Jordan years. I enjoyed them myself. And I have to say, so because you over here, you're a bit detached geographically. So it's easier to like turn away once things start to be not as nice as they used to be. But I followed the Bulls a little less after the Jordan years. So I enjoyed Tony Kukoc leading the team. Right after everybody left, and he was the only one there with Tim Floyd being the coach and everything.
Right, and I think Billy Weddington and Randy Brown stuck around for another year.
Right. Yeah, right. So. Everyone else left. Right, true. Yeah. Even Luke Longley left. He left to Phoenix. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So but how was it? How did the adaptation process go for a fan as crazy as you were? Like from being one of the best teams in sports history to
it was rough. It was definitely difficult. Because as I said a moment ago, I grew up and got used to, my favorite team wins the championship every year.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there was that you know, year in 93-94 where the Bulls got hosed in that second round series against the Knicks. You know, they lose a pivotal game five because of a questionable Hugh Hollins, you know, ghost foul. But that team without MJ, while MJ was playing baseball, was still a 50-plus win team. Scotty was whatever it was, you know, top three in MVP voting in the league that year, all-star game MVP that year. B.J. Armstrong was an all-star. Horace Grant was an all-star. That team was darn good, even without MJ. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, man, like we almost got to the finals without MJ. And then the following year, the crazy fervor of MJ coming back and then losing to Orlando in that series, you know, Nick Anderson steals the ball away from MJ in that game. And I was like, I wasn't used to not winning. But then, we readjust. We get Rodman. We get some toughness back after the departure of Horace Grant. And then we win the next 3 years, 3 straight championships. I was so used to winning championships. And then it was like, no, we sold off all our pieces. Here's Tim Floyd and... you know, let's look to the lottery and see what we can find. But knowing that we're going to be like a 15-20 win team for at least the next year or two, it was not hard. I mean, it was not easy, I should say, because I was so used to winning. I hated it. I still watch the team every night. I just watched the team lose every night, and it drove me crazy.
Oh, okay. That's compassion, but that's what I thought actually, because over here, like, you know, you as a fan, you watch the games, but it's like they are in the middle of the night, so either you stay up if it's a good game, or you watch them like relive or like the highlights. And so do you, like, with an 82 game season, so you really watch every single game every night. You get there and you either at home, you go to the pub, and you really watch every single one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I was a kid, it was religiously watched every game. So there was a rule in my family's household when we were kids, mm-hmm. growing up and going to school. And my parents were not a fan of TV. We had a TV in our living room, but pretty much during the school week, there was a strict no TV rule in our household. You can't watch TV during the school week. There was one exception to that rule, which is if you get your homework done between end of school and dinner time, after dinner, you can turn on the Bulls game and watch the Bulls. And so that was why I was a decent and maybe even slightly above decent student and always did my homework. Because I was like, well, that's a pretty easy trade-off. I'll do my homework because I want to watch the Bulls. And I even still stuck to that, even when I was watching, you know, Elton Brand and a bunch of nobodies, when I was watching Tyson Chandler and Eddie Curry, watching Ron Mercer, when I was, you know, these garbage Bulls teams that would just disappoint me every night, I still tuned in to watch because that team owned more than 50% of my heart at that point in my life.
It's like you mentioned it, those teams, like the Bulls after Jordan, and they like got new players and they looked different several times, but it never really worked out, did it? Until Rose came along, basically, and Noah and those guys.
So, I mean, when it so from 98, the end of the last championship, to 2003, when Jerry Krause was still the team's GM and tried to turn it over, he was so excited to prove that he could build a winner without Michael Jordan attached to it, right? Because Krause had that incredible ego and said, MJ's getting all the credit for these championships. Phil Jackson's getting all the credit for these championships. I want to build a winner without MJ and Phil. And that was his driving motivation. He couldn't do it. You know, like he made a lot of bold choices, because I thought when I watched Elton Brand his rookie year, I was like, this dude's a player. Mm-hmm. And then I was so confused when Krause was like, yeah, no, Elton Brand, not good enough. And then the whole, you know, the Twin Towers thing of Tyson Chandler and Eddie Curry, two largely untested, you know, high school products, basically. I guess you were still back in that day. NBA builds around bigs, right? Winners are mm-hmm. built around bigs, as opposed to today's game where bigs are becoming, you know, not inconsequential, but far less versatile and useful, given the way that the league has shifted. But and then that didn't work out. So I think when Krause finally said, all right, I'm done, I'm tapping out, and Reinsdorf, you know, let Jerry go, and John Paxson came in, and between 2003 and 2004, pretty much flipped the entire roster. Similar to what we're seeing Arturas Karnišovas and Mark Eversley do right now, since they took over a year ago, Paxson flipped the entire roster. And then, you know, he gets Ben Gordon in the draft and Luol Deng in the draft, and he drafts Kirk Heinrich, and he builds the Baby Bulls team. And then there are other complementary pieces to that Baby Bulls team. You know, Tyrus Thomas, obviously a bust considering LaMarcus Aldridge and what he went on to be. Yep. But, you know, you bring in Andres Nocioni, who was a big part of those Baby Bulls teams. And that team, actually, in the short span of a couple of years from when it was constructed by John Paxson, they knocked off the defending champion Heat in the first round of the playoffs a couple of years later. Like, you know, it didn't turn into a team that built and went on to championship contention, but it was a pretty successful overhaul of the roster. It just only went so far. And then, of course, you know, you're back and kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel, and you get super lucky in 2008 with Derrick Rose. So, you know, it was a weird journey to get from the end of the dynasty to where we are now. But yeah, I mean, when it comes to that 98 to 03 end of the Jerry Krause era, where he was trying and failing to prove that he could build a winner without MJ and Phil, it was really hard to watch. In my opinion, it was harder to watch those years than it has been to watch this recent rebuild. It was even worse.
Was it also because, I mean, in The Last Dance, we saw it, that the Kroos ended basically the dynasty prematurely, kind of, because he, as you said, wanted to prove that he could build a championship team without MJ and then Phil Jackson. Was it like people were even harder on him because he had like chosen that path and couldn't deliver afterwards what he wanted to deliver?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is no question that by and large, the majority of Bulls fans blame Jerry Krause for prematurely ending that team, breaking up that team. And I think some Bulls fans also, on top of Jerry Krause, blame Jerry Reinsdorf, the owner and the chairman, who agreed with Jerry Krause that it was time to break that team up. Because Jerry Reinsdorf, and he said that in the Last Dance documentary, from his perspective, it was, these guys are all aging out of their prime, and they are all going to get more money than their decaying bodies are worth on the market, because they are the name that they are attached to this dynasty team that we just, you know, we just had. So Reinsdorf was worried about the money and not overpaying for these aging players who he didn't think still had it in them to win. Mm-hmm. Krause was more concerned about just, he wanted to be rid of Phil Jackson. He wanted to be rid of MJ and Scotty and prove that he can win and build a winner without those guys. I tend to be a little bit more of a centrist as far as the overall population of Bulls fans when it comes to whether or not that team was prematurely dissolved and broken up. Because I do think when you look back at that final title in 98, an aging Michael Jordan carried that team through some not so easy playoff series. I mean, that Eastern Conference Finals against Reggie Miller's Pacers, the Bulls could have easily lost that series. I mean, the home team won all seven games, and the Bulls were trailing significantly in that pivotal game seven.
Yeah.
And the Pacers kind of choked it away. And then when you get to the finals, Scottie's back, you know, pulls out on him. Dennis is completely a head case at that point, and his body is aging and breaking down. Luke Longley's body is aging and breaking down. Ron Harper's body is aging and breaking down. Like, MJ carried that 98 team to a championship. I have my serious doubts that even in that lockout-shortened 99 season, that the Bulls were just going to waltz their way to a four straight title and their seventh in 9 years. I do not think it was going to be that easy for them.
So maybe Krause even did them a favor, like, in terms of their legacy, because they can claim, I mean, they would have won if they had stayed together. They would have won, maybe,
right,
probably, yeah.
And MJ said in that documentary, you know, I think we should have been able to stay together and defend what was ours until we were legitimately beaten. That was a more sensical passing of the torch in MJ's competitor frame of mind, and I get that. But as a Bulls fan whose childhood was just focused solely on rooting for that team, a perfectly, just like, it's a perfect little package of two three-peats, six titles in 8 years, probably will go down along with the Celtics as the second greatest NBA dynasty ever. And you went out on top. Like, thank goodness you went, you grinded through those 98 playoffs. You went out on top. You didn't, you were 6-for-6 in the NBA finals with MJ at the height of his power. I don't know if I would have enjoyed it as much and look back on that dynasty as fondly if they tried to do it again in 99 and it all fell apart and it left a really sour taste in all of our mouths.
Out in the second round or something, and like, nobody's happy anymore. And would not have been nice. Since you brought up MJ, how, just as a fan, growing up with him, being probably your childhood idol, he's my childhood idol, and now seeing him at The Last Dance and the interviews he's given, how does, I don't know, a grown-up Matt see MJ differently with what MJ's saying now? And even with the Luke Longley documentary where you always say, I have to be so competitive and everything. Is it like, has your perception changed a little?
Oh, it's very much so changed. I still idolize Michael Jordan, the Chicago sports icon, the guy who had six championships in 8 years for my favorite team. When I was a kid, I quite literally saw him as a deity, a god of some kind, a titan who was disguised on a basketball court in human form. I thought that man could do no wrong. He is the best person on the planet. He's Michael freaking Jordan. Because that's how he was marketed. That's how he was marketed to sports fans. It's how he was marketed to kids. Gatorade, be like Mike. I wanted to be like Mike. I was a short, chubby white kid who was bad at basketball, but I wanted to be like Mike.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, I thought that man could do no wrong. And then, you know, all of the stories that you heard about, he's a little too much of a gambler, or he's got this dark thing that he's hiding in a closet, or, you know, this, that, and the, like the media built him up and then slowly tried to tear him down, because that's what they do to public figures. And I think they did a really good job illustrating that in the Last Dance documentary, of just how much MJ's trajectory was, I am the most liked, loved, adored person on the planet, to the media looking and poking into closets, trying to find ways to bring him down. And I can't imagine how frustrating that was. But yeah, as I've grown up and become an adult and study the history of not only the Bulls organization, but Michael Jordan, the person, he's a human. He's a human with personality flaws and character flaws, and has a person who has made bad decisions, who has treated certain people poorly, all because of the person he is and how he operates. Mm-hmm. And it's also very strange to, you know, MJ has always been and always will be older than me by, you know, a couple of decades. Like, you know, I'm in my mid-30s. He's, you know, on, you know, between 50 and 60. It's been weird being someone who has gone from a kid who idolizes professional athletes and looks up to them as role models and, you know, and in some cases like MJ, just gods who could do no wrong, to now being in my mid-30s and covering sports for a living, and realizing like, oh, dude, these are 22, 23-year-old young men and women. These are not deities. These are not gods. They're human beings, and they have flaws just like you and me. And it's a weird shift in your frame of mind, because it's not only changed the way that I view Michael Jordan over the years, but it's just changed the way that I view athletes over the years. Because when you're a kid and you have posters of these people on your wall,
right? Yeah.
I mean, I still do as an adult, as you can see. But
so do I. So. You look at,
right? Yeah. I mean, I was about to compliment you earlier on the MJ North Carolina buzzer beater I see behind you. It is weird how it just kind of twists a little bit in your mind as you age. You'd be like, oh yeah, no, like these aren't gods. These aren't immortal, you know, perfect people. They are people with flaws, and MJ clearly. When you watch that doc, you're like, man, MJ was an asshole. I'm sorry if you have to bleep that, but MJ was an asshole.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I didn't think it was remotely possible or conceivable that guy who I worshipped was a bad guy in any way, shape, or form, because he was only marketed to people as, this is MJ. It gets no better than Michael Jordan.
It's so funny because I just watched the Luke Longley documentary the other weekend. And when I watched it, and it was great that MJ came on.
Oh, it was fantastic. I wanted it to be like an hour longer than it was.
Yeah, definitely. And so when I thought when I watched him there, and when he said, you know, that video footage of the whole team hanging out at Luke Longley's place, and MJ was like, I would have liked to go out with them, but it didn't help us win. I thought in my mind, I was like, but it probably wouldn't have stopped you. So it kind of felt like that was the first time to me that he kind of, or not the first time, but that it really came to me that he seems very trapped in his, like, this is the way to win. And I need to be, I don't know, on another stage as everyone else. Cause I'm the one who gets us there. And I'm the one who drags everyone. Like, I don't know. Maybe he needed that mindset to be as great as a basketball player as he was. Because, I mean, as you said, that 98 finals run was amazing.
Yeah. And look, I mean, Luke Longley talked about it in that documentary that Australian Story did. And again, you know, if any of your listeners haven't watched it, highly recommend that they do. I thought it was great. Luke Longley said, yeah, I was just a kid who happened to be 7'2". And so I was like, oh, basketball. This is a place where I can, you know, have some fun on a basketball court. But it was with Luke, it was about having fun. And he was a very easygoing guy. He talked about being, you know, a gentle giant, to use that phrase. And that even in his collegiate career, when he was playing with the Lobos, he got a little bit of negative press because he talked about how, I guess maybe not working out as much as I should, or, you know, I'm a little lazier than I should be, and realized that, hey, if I want to actually take this to the next level, first Australian ever taken in the NBA draft, and he was taken top 10. Wow. And then went to play on that Minnesota team, and that Minnesota team was garbage. And he gets traded to Chicago. MJ comes out of retirement, and Luke has this awakening of like, oh, I need to work a lot harder, and I need to be a lot better. Because whether it was Luke Longley or any other Michael Jordan teammate over the years, he had to pull that out of a lot of them. And the way that he phrased it in the doc that I thought was pretty apt was, look, before I can trust these guys when we go into the trenches of trying to win playoff games and win championships, if they can't stand up to me and if they can't handle the heat that I give them in practice, how the heck do they think that, and how the heck can I like have faith in them standing up to the heat of real battle? And you can't deny that logic.
No,
I mean, it worked.
Yeah.
Over the years of that team and that team's success, and the fact that other than Scottie Pippen, the first three-peat and the second three-peat were built of entirely different players. Entirely different players. One of the things that was a mainstay and a constant in all of the variables was Michael Jordan's leadership style. And the fact that, hey, maybe there were some practices and some days where his teammates hated his guts. But when it came time for Steve Kerr to prove himself, when it came time for Scott Burrell to prove himself, or whoever it may have been, because MJ was hard on them, they rose to occasions when they needed to rise to occasions.
That's true. I totally understand that thought process, basically. And it worked for him. I mean, nobody proved him wrong, right? So why would he regret anything or something? So that makes total sense. But the great thing about Joakim Noah is he didn't win a championship, but he competed hard and he's still very likable. And so was that team. I mean, when I think back at that team, like with Noah, with Taj Gibson, Chicago kid Derrick Rose, was that maybe the, like, playing hard with Tom Thibodeau as a coach, was that maybe the perfect team for the city of Chicago to, I don't know, that matched the city of Chicago perfectly?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I graduated from college and moved back to Chicago, and not, you know, back home to the suburbs, but like moved to the city of Chicago proper in the fall of 2009. So right after that epic seven-game Bulls-Celtics first-round series where Derrick Rose has this amazing coming-out party, set then record for most points in a rookie playoff debut. And it was an amazing series. It was heartbreaking that the Bulls lost it. But so moving to Chicago at that point, this city was hyped about that team. Coming into that next season, 2009-2010, they fall short that season, but Derrick Rose goes from being Rookie of the Year to All-Star. They lose to LeBron in the first round of the playoffs, because of course they do. And then that next summer, the decision summer, right?
Yeah.
It's LeBron leaves. The Bulls are one of the teams that is always being talked about as one of the most likely suitors, one of the most likely outcomes for LeBron's decision to leave Cleveland. And he goes to Miami instead. And Wade recruits him to Miami and recruits Chris Bosh to Miami. And the Bulls get consolation prize Carlos Boozer. And it's like, okay, fine, whatever. We built out the rest with, we spent some money building a really solid bench. And we have this young Chicago hometown kid who just was an all-star in his second season and says in their, you know, media day press conference at the start of that 10-11 season, why can't I be the MVP of the league? Like, why not? The city of Chicago that season, when the Bulls made that, you know, 20-win jump and were the top seed in the East, top seed in the NBA, Derrick Rose was the MVP. I lived in Chicago that season and felt the electricity of Bulls fans in Chicago. It's different. When the Bulls are that good, this city goes insane for regular season games. Mm-hmm. You know, it's bars are packed with people watching the game, walking up and down the streets, people wearing all Bulls gear. You can have a friendly conversation with a complete stranger because you're both wearing Bulls gear. You talk about the game from last night. Oh, nice. My gosh, dude, did you see D Rose last night? 33, 10, and 9. Like, it was an explosion of the city remembering what it was like to root for a winner, because we hadn't had it at that point in over 10 years since the dynasty broke up. So, yeah, that team, the Tom Thibodeau, Derrick Rose, Joakim Noah, Taj Gibson team, Luol Deng,
right.
That really reinvigorated my passion for this team. I mean, I had never lost the passion. The flame was always still burning. But that made me feel, for the first time since I was a kid, as insanely obsessed with the Bulls than I had been in that long gap of years. Because I remember being a kid at the United Center, watching MJ and Scotty, and feeling like, this is the most important thing in my life. This game right now is the most important thing in my life. And I didn't feel that way for a long time until that Derrick Rose led team and being at the United Center for some of those epic games where the United Center crowd was just exploding. The Bulls go on a big run. Opponent takes a timeout. Joakim Noah's like hooting, like pounding his chest.
Yeah.
And he goes back to the Bulls and the place just erupts. And the hair, I mean, I'm getting like the hair standing on the back of my neck right now, even thinking about that memory. Because that's how it made you feel. And that's how it made you feel when you were a kid watching MJ and the Dynasty. And that's why there is such a correlation there in my mind and in my heart of the Jordan Dynasty years and that Derek and Joakim team, because they made me feel the same way about the team and being a fan of the team.
Yeah, they finally paid you back for sticking with the team through the rough years.
Through some really, really dark years.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, as you said, that the whole city gets electric about the Bulls. Usually, how's the hierarchy in the city with the Bears, the Bulls, the Cubs, White Sox, Blackhawks?
So usually, I would say the Bulls are second only to the Bears. Mm-hmm. I think always Chicago will be a Bears town. Even though we haven't won a Super Bowl since 1985, this is always a Bears town. And I think when the Bulls are even somewhat watchable, even if they're a 500 team, the Bulls are second in the city of Chicago. And then, of course, the baseball fans are split, north side, south side,
right, yeah.
Cubs, Sox. And usually the Blackhawks are fifth. But while the Bulls were kind of, you know, struggling and meandering, while the Cubs were rebuilding up to that 2016 World Series run, while the White Sox were trash, the Blackhawks won 3 Stanley Cups in 6 years.
Yeah.
So like there was this huge upswing, and I will readily admit I was not much of a hockey fan when I was a kid. The Blackhawks were not ever very good, and they didn't even televise a lot of their home games because their old owner was like, oh, yeah, well, if we televise the home games, then nobody will come to the stadium. Yeah. Sound logic, right?
Of course, yeah.
But so, you know, when the Blackhawks, all of a sudden, you know, in back-to-back drafts, they get Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane, and then all of a sudden, boom, like they have these other people. They're an amazing team. I jumped on like a fair-weather fan and fell in love with hockey. And I've been a pretty devout and diehard Blackhawks fan ever since. But like for a while, for a span of about 5 years, yeah. Chicago was Blackhawks and hockey crazy. When the Blackhawks broke up and everybody's like, yeah. Blackhawks. So I would say by and large, the Bulls are always number two on that list behind the Bears.
Okay. Yeah, it's funny because I think I was in Chicago in 2014 and there it really like wherever you went, every sports store, all Blackhawks gear everywhere. And it was really, I was trying to get a Jimmy Butler jersey back then and he was still like up and coming and I didn't find one. I couldn't buy one. I didn't. So yeah, I went home with a T-shirt instead. At least you know. But it was a Blackhawks Hawks town back then.
It was, and also the Bulls are really stingy about where they sell their merchandise.
Yeah, that was. I thought. I mean, being in Chicago, I thought that would be really easy to actually buy Bulls gear, and I ended up with that Nice.
No, because they want you to buy it from their store.
From their store, yeah.
Oh, where they charge you whatever the heck they want for it.
Yeah, right. do they actually sell the black City Edition, is it City Edition, Patrick Williams jersey somewhere in Chicago? Because you can't get it in Europe.
So I had to order mine custom from the official Bulls NBA website. I have one.
Okay.
It was the jersey that I bought at the beginning of last season when I was really falling in love with Patrick Williams' game and thought that those Chicago like Art Deco style City Edition jerseys were really cool looking.
All right. Yeah.
And I was like, and I'm going to get one. I had to send an email for a request of a form to then get a custom Patrick Williams jersey made. It was a process.
Okay.
And it took me like 2 months to get it.
Wow.
And then I got the jersey. I finally got the jersey after months of going through this process. A week later, they traded for Vooch. And he gave number 9 to Vooch. Yeah. But so now I was actually pretty excited about that, because now I feel like I have this collector's item of Patrick Williams' number 9 jersey that he only wore for half of his rookie year.
Yeah. And once he's a superstar, that'd be worth a lot of money, or you really love having it. So I'll
put it on the wall behind next to Miami.
Get it signed by him, man. since we got to Patrick Williams, I think let's skip to today, because I like when you set the guard packs, they like overhaul the whole roster. That's what Arturs Kanisovas and Mark Eversley did now. And there is this, at least for me, because it feels like, the Bulls are back. So they got really interesting players. And I remember last summer when everybody was a bit disappointed that they only signed Garrett Temple and them did not much else in free agency and drafted Patrick Williams. Just from your perception, what has changed around the Bulls now with the new front office?
I think a lot has changed. The fact that not one, but two pretty big name free agents in Lonzo Ball and DeMar DeRozan chose to come to Chicago is a big change in itself. I think Gar Forman and John Paxson were always obsessed with trying to build through the draft while conserving and creating cap space. Right. We're going to give ourselves all this financial flexibility. They were always obsessed with the phrase financial flexibility. So while we have this homegrown talent, hopefully we can spend all this money that we have, this cap space that we have either created or maintained, to sign that big name, whoever that big name is. And they failed time and again. Yep. They failed to get that big name. They got close to LeBron James and Dwayne Wade. And they failed.
Yep.
They got close to Carmelo Anthony, and they failed. So that is the biggest shift to me, is having a front office that not only has the aggressiveness to say, screw trying to build through the draft and only the draft, and screw cap space for a rainy day when maybe we'll get somebody. We're going to go get pieces right now that help our roster and address specific needs of our roster. Because that, to me, is the other big shift. When Gar and John did spend money, they didn't spend it wisely. They spent it on pieces that made no sense when you were trying to figure out, okay, what does this team need? What does this team have? And how should we spend our money? Because, you know, especially towards the back end of their regime, where you're talking about signings like Dwayne Wade and Rajon Rondo.
Yeah.
They say we're going to get younger and more athletic. And then they spend collectively $30 million on Dwayne Wade and Rajon Rondo. It made no freaking sense.
No.
Jabari Parker? I know, Chicago hometown kid, former number 2 pick in the draft, wanted to see if he could reinvigorate his career here in Chicago. But as far as what that Bulls roster needed, giving Jabari Parker $20 million made no freaking sense whatsoever.
No, it didn't.
So the fact that they are making logical decisions as far as addressing roster needs, using money to go out and get guys, and the fact that they're actually convincing guys to come play here. I mean, that is a tripod of three stark differences compared to their predecessors.
It sure is. And it's like, it's not, they're not going the obvious way. Okay, Lonzo's been circling around for a couple of months, but when they traded for Vooch, for example, that came kind of out of the blue. Nobody really expected mm-hmm. them to do that. And same with DeRozan, like the rumor started piling up right before the trade, but it wasn't right. like they need to get after DeRozan. So they just did. And that's something I kind of like, that they seem to be thinking out of the box a little. And right. even with, yeah. as you said, like they didn't really have cap space, right? They just like performed above the cap basically. And mm-hmm. so that, I
yeah.
think.
And I mean, even just the fact that they were able to orchestrate these sign-in trades. Yep. And look, maybe as we record this, we're still waiting for the results right. of the league's investigation into possible tampering when it comes specifically to the Lonzo Ball and Pelicans deal, because it was a sign-in trade with several moving parts that they announced at 6:01 Eastern time. And
they could have
like,
waited
okay.
a little longer, right? A little longer, right. just 10 minutes or something.
I'm sure that the Bulls front office is not super thrilled with Rich Paul right now, because clearly Clutch Sports are the ones who leaked yeah. that. Because the Bulls would not be so willy-nilly to do that yeah. and say, okay, here we are. We have this great deal. Let's announce it 1 minute after the yeah. window opens. But the fact that they were able to do those, I don't think Gar Forman and John Paxson even knew what a sign and trade was. I mean, like they were really good at making trades that put cash in their pockets, right?
Yeah.
Oh, we're trading such and such player for cash considerations.
Oh, yeah.
Or we're trading this pick for cash considerations. I mean, that phrase drove Bulls fans mad for years, because that seemed to be the only trades that they would make. Especially, you know, you brought up the Vooch trade at the deadline this past season. I know Bulls fans who maybe had misguided expectations about the back end of the season after that trade mm-hmm. were disappointed that this team didn't make the playoffs. But I think there's a lot more context to that. But the fact that they even made a big swing trade to get an all-star caliber player at the deadline, mid-season? I mean, Gar and John never did that. I mean, year after year, Bulls fans would be like talking for weeks leading up to the trade deadline. Who's out there? Who can we get? What piece do we want to add? What do we want? And it was like, oh, yeah, well, here we go. It's trade deadline day. The Bulls traded this pick for cash considerations, or We traded away Kirk Heinrich, or we traded to get Kirk Heinrich back. That's yeah. all they did on trade deadline day. And it's like, wow, how refreshing is it to have a front office that is actually active on trade deadline day, that is prepared for trade deadline day, that is active and prepared for the first day and first hours of free agency, when for years it seemed like we had a front office that was just sitting in a room with their phones unplugged.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it feels like a world of difference through the first year of this new regime.
Sure does. And were you a bit upset that they parted ways with Wendell Carter, or did you feel like...
Look, I mean, I was never super high on Wendell.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, he had certain strengths to his game, and I think he was integral to the defensive schemes and systems that Jim Boylan was hell-bent on playing for a couple of seasons there. Because Wendell could mask a lot of the other, shortfalls and weaknesses of the Bulls' defensive cohesive unit.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of that, I mean, he for whatever reason... Maybe, like, I wonder if he got the yips or if he just lost any and all confidence, because after he showed some promise on the offensive end his rookie year, he came back his second year and looked like someone who was not interested at even looking at a basketball hoop. And I always thought he was a little uncoordinated on the offensive end. Like, a center should be able to catch a basketball when they're trying to establish post position. And Wendell is someone who at 6'9 is undersized to play that position and always seemed to me to have really bad hands.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bad combination. So as talented as you might be on the defensive end, like, you know, nobody's scared of Rudy Gobert's offensive game,
mm-hmm.
but the dude's over 7 feet tall and a perennial defensive of the year player. Wendell was never going to be that on the defensive end. And I don't think he ever will be that on the defensive end, as good as he is, because he's 6'9".
Yep.
So, you know, how many players that size have gone on to be a perennial defensive player of the year candidate? Because I think the answer is one, and it's Ben Wallace. Mm-hmm. He's not the rule. He's the exception. I wish Wendell luck in Orlando and wherever his career takes him. But if the question is, was I devastated to give him up in a trade that netted us a center who is bigger and better, a walking 20 and 10 double-double who is still in his prime? No. I cried no tears over Wendell with that trade.
Even on second thought. But Vooch, I think he will once they like learn how to play with each other, I think he'll fit nicely along Zach LaVine. And now with Lonzo being there and DeMar DeRozan being there and Caruso coming off the bench and everything. So how did you like the moves in general? How did you like the signings and how do you see the fit with the new guys who are coming on?
I mean I was a big fan of all of these signings. When it comes to, and it's interesting as we're talking about Vooch, I think he's kind of the piece that's being a little bit overlooked and ignored right now.
Yeah, sure.
We got him mid-season.
Yeah.
And we're like, now, you know, it's like a kid who gets a new toy. It's like, oh, yeah, I've played with Woody enough. Yeah. Now I have Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, Lonzo and DeMar are Buzz Lightyear. And Vooch is Woody saying, hey, I'm still a pretty awesome toy, too. Yeah. And I think going back to the conversation of the Bulls, you know, failing to make the playoffs, Vooch's arrival was difficult timing-wise in that, you know, the Bulls get him in a trade and they go out on that West Coast road trip.
Yeah.
And they play some of the best teams in the league. And they play him pretty evenly. The Bulls had a lot of really close losses on that road trip. And it was as they were learning to play together on the fly with no practices. They had no time to practice in this crazy condensed NBA schedule. Even with that being the case, I thought that Zach and Vooch, towards the back end of their games together, were starting to build a pretty solid two-man chemistry and some two-man games that were pretty lethal on the offensive end. And then Zach has to go into health and safety protocols and boom, everything blows up.
Yeah.
So I, as much as I'm looking forward to Lonzo and DeMar and seeing what they add, I am just as excited to see the continued building of chemistry of Zach and Vooch as very lethal pieces and partners on the offensive end. But Lonzo obviously is a guy who could do a lot for you in transition. Maybe not the quintessential and prototypical like pass first point guard that Bulls fans have been hoping for. He's certainly more of a pass guard than a shoot guard, but we did see in the tail end of his time in New Orleans, he can play on or off the ball because he was playing off the ball more when they were running a lot of their offense through Zion, and Lonzo raised his 3-point threat to 38% because he was playing off the ball more. That's something that the Bulls will certainly find useful. And he's 6'6" and gives you length and competency on the defensive end, which this Bulls backcourt desperately needed.
Yep.
Caruso gives you similar things. The point of attack guard, who's one of, by metrics, the best point of attack defensive guards in the league last season. Something that the Bulls desperately needed. And DeMar DeRozan, that is the weird one to me when it comes to NBA talking heads and national pundits saying, well, why don't they get DeRozan? They have Zach LaVine. They're basically the same player. I don't know what you're watching if you think that Zach LaVine and DeMar DeRozan are the same player. They're very different.
They are.
And DeMar's abilities, DeMar was one of the best players in the league last season at getting to the free throw line. The Bulls were dead last in free throw attempts per game last season. That's addressing a need. DeRozan, despite operating pretty much exclusively mid-range and in, still had an above 60 true shooting percentage last season. That's like wildly impossible mathematically. He is super efficient. And he is going to be a individual who takes some of that late game clutch, crunch time minutes pressure off of Zach LaVine, who has never been great creating in those late game, close game scenarios. DeRozan is clutch. And if we have options of, okay, yeah, Zach, you double Zach if you want to, here's DeRozan, who is going to get a bucket. The dude is great at creating his own looks and is a better and more gifted playmaker than Zach LaVine at this point. I mean, I think I saw it on Twitter today. There were only 7 or 8 players in the entire NBA who had more point assist double doubles than DeMar DeRozan last season.
Okay. Yeah.
The guy finished top 10 in the league in assists per game last season. So it's not just mid-range, and it's not just getting the free throw line. You're getting another playmaker and creator to help, you know, supplement the fact that Lonzo is lethal in transition and a very gifted passer, but isn't necessarily running your half-court offense all the time. So I thought all of the signings made a lot of sense.
That's a good point. Because that's what I thought, that they addressed the backcourt multidimensionally. You know, with the you got the transition playmaker and the facilitator with Lonzo, and then you got the half-court playmaker with DeRozan, and you got the point of attack defender. So it's right. It's not like you got didn't get this one player who can do it all, but you got three different players who can do different things. And that is, and you got you still got Pat, who's a great cutter around. You got Zach, who can play off the ball. So I think it makes offensively it makes a lot of sense. And so defensively, yeah, I get it. So not everybody, they're not the best defenders, but I thought Zach did a good job yet last year. Like he improved a lot last year. And it was funny how national commentators, it took him a while from the perception of Zach being a bad defender. They needed to watch several games before they were like, okay, I leave that behind. He's still not a good defender, but he's not a really, really bad defender anymore. He's trying and he's got his lapses, but he's gotten better. And it's like when you don't watch the team constantly, you got your mind made up basically. And it took him a while.
And look, even like, so yes, there is some significant overhaul to this roster compared to last season. And yes, I mean, you can't deny that DeRozan is a net negative defender. I don't think he's as awful as some pundits are making it out to be with why getting DeRozan and giving up what you did for him was dumb, because it's like, oh, well, let's just ignore all he's given you on the offensive end. His defense is so bad. It's so awful. Look, you know, I agree with you. I thought Zach made a big step last season defensively. Hopefully he'll take another big step. You saw defense being his primary focus on that USA Olympic team, and good for him for making that his focus. Hopefully he can bring some of that to this season with the Bulls. Billy Donovan led the Bulls to a top 12 defensive team last season. And look, yes, there are differences in the roster, but it's not like you lost any defensive gems. Maybe one in Garrett Temple, but
you got Caruso.
Who else did you lose? Yeah, you traded Wendell midseason, but again, as I expressed, it's not like Wendell by himself was making you a solid defensive team. Who else did you lose? Who else did you say goodbye to? You had Tice for half a season. I would call him a positive defensive player, but you know, and you lost Thad Young, so there's some competent defense there, but you got Patrick Williams, you added Lonzo Ball, you added Alex Caruso. I think Tony Bradley, as sort of like a low-key, you know, latter days free agency signing, can give you some rim protection and a little bit of interior defense. And guess what? If your offense is as lethal as it has the potential to be with that starting five, good offense beats good defense 10 times out of 10 every night in this league. It's just a fact.
That's true. That's true. And I think they're going to be really, really good offensively. I think you need to get going soon, right? So
I do. I'm coming up on it a little bit right now.
Yeah. So just one last question. What went wrong with Lowry? Where did it go wrong?
Man.
Short one to finish it off.
I am so frustrated and disappointed. And as we sit here recording this, it is still possible that he ends up taking a qualifying offer and playing out one more year with the Bulls in a likely reserve role, as he is just sort of, you know, they're playing musical chairs and there are only a couple of chairs left and the music's slowing down and Lowry's one of the last guys left unsigned. I feel bad for him. And certainly I think that he was maybe led down a difficult road by his agent, who maybe told him that he was worth more than he was. Mm. Because he and the Bulls talked about an extension a year ago. They were far enough apart that the Bulls said, we're not getting this done because we don't think you're worth that right now. And Lowry bet on himself by turning down that extension that was offered. And unlike Jimmy Butler, who bet on himself with a contract offer extension at the end of his and won because he bet on himself and then won Most Improved Player Award, Lowry bet on himself and lost. So, look, there are a lot of factors. Do I think that Jim Boylan and his offensive system and basically turning Lowry into nothing but a roaming perimeter threat hindered Lowry mentally, in addition to limiting the development of his game physically. Yeah, because how is it that you're a 7-footer who can't even attack a, as Stacey King would say, mouse in the house mismatch? It's like Lowry has post position, or theoretically should have post position, with a 6'4 guard on him. He's 7 feet tall, and he's not even asking for the ball. Or when he does ask for the ball and get the ball, he can't even back down a dude who's 6'4".
Yeah,
it was so incredibly frustrating to watch, because you saw glimmers of potential of Lowry being that crazy Swiss Army knife player who is 7 feet tall, who can shoot the three, who can put the ball on the floor, and can be lethal at all three levels offensively. And for whatever reason, if it was a lack of confidence in himself, if it was a lack of motivation, if it was on top of that poor coaching that made him not buy in to trying to get better and buy into the system, I mean, it could be any and all of those possibilities to what went wrong with Lowry Markkanen. But as someone who believed in his star potential after his rookie year, I got to say, this is one of the cases where I am most upset that I turned out to be wrong. And I hope that Lowry gets the fresh start he's looking for, and maybe what he needs is the right system. Because the other thing that I think Lowry never had that could have really benefited from in his first five NBA seasons with the Chicago Bulls, an actual point guard.
Yeah,
an actual point guard that could get Lowry looks in spots where he wanted the ball and can really build up Lowry's offensive potency. Lowry never had a competent point guard in his time with the Bulls, and that's not his fault.
Nope.
Some of the shortcomings of his development are his fault, in my opinion. That is one that is the fault of this organization, who never got Lowry a point guard to help him grow. So maybe he finds a new home with a competent point guard that can bring that potential out of him. I'm very disappointed it didn't happen for him in a Bulls jersey, and I wish him nothing but the best. But yeah, it stung, because I really, really believed in him after his rookie year.
Yeah, me too. Even after that one, the first game against Charlotte in 2019-2020 season, we got 50 points or something. The team was bad, and he was just like, I was like, yeah, come on, Lowry.
Yeah.
That's going to be.
Yeah.
And then... Yeah, but if I think in the end, he always like seemed a bit detached. You know, he got the ball like somewhere around the top of the key, and then it was like him either taking the shot or put it on the floor. But he's never like really worked inside of the team's flow, kind of in the past 2 years. So it never really. So maybe the fresh start is just what he needs, and hopefully gets it.
The way that my buddy Kendall Gill, you know, longtime NBA vet, described it to us when we were talking about Lowry in the green room one day was. He called him a point of least resistance player. So Lowry's not going to force his will. Lowry's not going to impose his will on any moment of any basketball game, despite having the size of somebody who could and the talent of somebody who could and should do that. He never, ever did that. And that is probably just as much a mental makeup thing as it is how much basketball skill and talent do you have.
That's true. That's actually like a good description.
That's correct. My boy, Big Dave, and I.
Right.
Monday through Friday, 5 days a week, talking Bulls. Talking Bulls, probably too much. Too much Bulls talk. But if you want more,
you can never
you know where to find it.
Can never talk too much Bulls. So do that. Because I usually, you know, I can't do an hour podcast. I usually only get 2 minutes per episode because I always know how to mix them in. So now I got 2 minutes per episode. So.
Well, hopefully the Bulls are a little bit more of a mainstream storyline this season, because they have not gotten a lot of national NBA coverage over the last few years, but they've made some interesting additions. And if they start winning some games out of the gate, I think that you'll see them start to get a little bit more coverage because, you know, it's the Bulls. I think the NBA likes it when the Bulls are relevant because they are a huge team with a huge global following.
They are. Maybe they get a Christmas game even. You never know if they're good.
I hate to burst your bubble, but as we were recording, I just saw the final schedule.
Oh, no.
No Bulls on Christmas Day. I was hoping for it. I was really hoping for it. I wanted Bulls-Knicks on Christmas Day. Oh, I thought it would be perfect.
That would have been perfect.
But right. it's Knicks-Hawks. It's a rematch of the first round from last year.
Okay, they got the Trae Young thing. They got the Trae Young thing. But Thibs coming back to the United Center would have been nice. But well, next year then. Next year.
Next year. There's always next year.
All right, Matt. Thanks so much for being on. Take care. See you soon.
Thanks for having me, Max. Appreciate it, man. Anytime.